in the interim of other solutions, whether we like it or not, people are turning to the solutions that right. are available to them. There's a whole bunch of reasons why using ChatGPT for mental health is dangerous. And there's lots of reasons why people shouldn't use it. But like, we have to have empathy for the situation.
In this week's episode of Neural Compass, the business of mental health, Steve Duke and I discuss trends in the mental health business, from the rise of AI-powered therapy to advances in therapeutics and med devices. We talk about his personal journey and why he brought his McKinsey-trained analytical skills to mental health, and what he sees as the biggest challenges for innovators in our field. I love this conversation, and hope you will too. Hello, and welcome to Neural Compass. I am Mark Jacobstein, founding president of Jiminy Health. I am really excited to be here today with Steve Duke, who has done many things in his career, but most notably right now is the CEO and founder and primary voice of the Hemingway Group, which puts out a report, which for all those of us who work in the mental health business has become a must read. This report comes out weekly and covers everything from the business of mental health through to emerging technologies, efficacy, et cetera. So first of all, Steve, I want to talk about your journey to building the Hemingway Report. This isn't something that is obvious sort of from your prior work in your career, that this would be what you would do. And, you know, you were a McKinsey consultant, and there are many paths you could have taken. So talk to me a little bit about why you got started with this.
Yeah. So it was a few years ago, I was working at a fintech startup, and I just left that. And I'd kind of been in the McKinsey and startup like sphere, kind of grinding away for like a number of years. And I loved it. But I'd kind of taken each of those steps as by just saying yes to like cool opportunities that came up. And I wanted to be much more intentional about like what I did next. And so I actually took a big trip. I drove around Australia for like 4 months, and I was like, this is my figuring it out phase. Like, I'm going to go and figure out what I want to do. And what I landed on was actually a very close version to what I'm doing today, which was combining a cause I care about deeply, which is mental health. And that's actually, you know, when I look back, that was obvious for a very long time that I was almost going to end up like working in this space with something that I really enjoy doing, which is kind of writing in-depth analysis and then trying to do it in a way that I actually am hopefully like contributing to solutions in the space, right? So I don't have a clinical background. I'm not a clinician, so I can't go out and actually treat people directly. And I was like, well, what can I do? Well, I've helped to grow and scale businesses, and I kind of have good analytical and research capabilities. So can I use that to try and help the founders and the people who are building the businesses in the mental health space to solve some of their problems? Because it's hard, as you probably know, it's hard to build these businesses. It's hard to make money. It's hard to deliver clinical outcomes. It's hard to build good product. So I was like, right, if I can just on the margin help these kinds of people with the analysis and the writing that I'm doing, then that would be something that would be great. And I really like it. That's the main thing. I actually really enjoy doing this stuff.
Well, then it's the right work. And there's a couple of great threads in there I want to pull on, including the fact that building any startup is hard. Building in the mental health space, as with all healthcare startups, I think have their own unique challenges related in part to like the payer, provider, patient triad, and the fact that it is not a dyad, and that the people who are paying for things are not the same as the people who are sort of receiving the benefits. But mental health is its own particular challenges related to, you know, a century of challenges really at the intersection of efficacy and access, where we have sort of twin problems, and maybe we'll get more into that. But I love this idea of the intentionality of working on something you wanted to work on. But also, I hadn't thought about this, but I guess in addition to the McKinsey work, before this, you were focused on growth inside of your startups, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is we're going to think about how to make mental health oriented businesses grow, do that in a deeply analytical way. And I know you've discussed this, you know, your own personal challenges with stuff earlier in your life. And so the mental health field in particular kind of has a real personal pull.
Yeah, massively. And I've actually just been reflecting on this in the last couple of days. The reason from a very young age, I kind of had my own experience with mental health. When I was 11, I was diagnosed with OCD. And I was, you know, it was a really, really rough place, like for me at the time, like especially as a kid. And I was lucky that I had you know, parents who kind of picked up on it and had the means to like get me support. I was lucky that I saw a great psychologist. And so I responded really well to the treatment. And, you know, it gave me a couple of things. One was like deep empathy for somebody who lives with a mental disorder, right? I know at least a version of what it's like to go through that. And then also give me a lot of hope, because if you had told 11-year-old me before I'd actually gotten any support that my life could be the way it was, you know, 6 months or 12 months later, I don't think I would have believed you. But then you go through the process, you're like, oh, you know, you can actually get better, right? You can you can have a vastly different experience of your life if you can kind of get the right treatment, if the right people are there to help you. And so from a very young age, I kind of had that. And then, like most people, as you go through life, you have other people in your life who experience things. And you know, that just deeply impacts me. And, you know, the reason I was thinking about it recently, because in Australia, there was a couple of AFL players who unfortunately recently took their own lives. And then I had somebody, you know, in my social circle who I don't know directly, but like take their own life over the weekend. And, you know, every now and again, it hits you that like, oh shit, like
this is real.
This is real. Yeah, exactly. Like this is real stuff. Like,
yeah. Well, so first of all, thank you for sharing the personal story. I admire the courage. And I think one of the really important things that's happened in the mental health field in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, last decade maybe, is more and more people being willing to talk about their own mental health challenges. I do as well. I struggled with anxiety for a good 15 or 20 years, and it took several therapists and a lot of hard work. And I'm a much happier and healthier person for the work that happened. But I think it's a field that is full of people who, many of whom have either had their own struggles or are touched by somebody who has, and that's part of why that, you know, they ultimately decided this was very important. But I take your point here in regards to like an incredibly important social problem. I sometimes describe anxiety, depression, mental health challenges as the ultimate comorbidity. It's not only do these things make people unhappy, potentially in the most catastrophic scenario, make people suicidal, but they also bring everything else down, right? Everything from your own physical health becomes a comorbidity for your heart disease or your diabetes or what have you, but also even social ills. I mean, I tend to think that a lot of what is happening in the world that is not so positive and dis and misinformation, so many of these things I think of as are ultimately underpinned by things like fear, which is another word for anxiety. Anyways, again, thank you for the courage and for the work. I think it's something that a lot of us in the field share. One other question for you. So I've read you call the report the Hemingway report, which I think is interesting. Total coincidence. I happen to be reading A Farewell to Arms right now for the first time in my life. I don't know how that happened. I got to 55 years old and I'm finally reading A Farewell to Arms. But talk to me about why the name and the admiration for Hemingway.
Yes. So I really like Hemingway as a writer. Just always appeals to me. He's very direct and precise in his writing, which just something that always resonated with me. I just love it. And he lived on a personal level, he had many flaws, but he lived a life of like great adventure, and he's very like bold and courageous. And I kind of admired that part of him. And so there was a time when I was playing around with different projects, I used to give them code names. And so I had a project Michelangelo and other different code names, but they were all named after kind of influential people who had lived with some sort of mental disorder. Now they didn't have, you know, the DSM-5 background. Michelangelo was floating around, but like most people reckoned like he probably lived with something and similar with Hemingway. And Hemingway actually took his own life at the end of it. And so, yeah, I used to name them after these people that I kind of admired, but had lived with some form of mental
stress. It's a long list, right? Churchill and
right.
And I
super
suspect
long.
It's actually a much longer list than we realize. I mean, anxiety is omnipresent and is certainly part of, I mean, it's part of what kept us alive on the savannas and isn't necessarily in and of itself a problematic thing. But we live in an anxious time, and I don't think there's anything in our evolutionary history that sort of prepared us for the way life is now. I think this is all part of why we have even more challenges. And we'll get into this because some of your own research looks at what's happened with you know, struggles, particularly with young people and with mental health challenges over the course of the last few decades and how things have changed pretty dramatically. But I love that. I do think there is something about the clarity and concision of what Hemingway brought to his writing that one would want to achieve with, you know, analysis. I suspect he would have struggled to work with a therapist, but I'm not sure. Hard to know.
Yeah, I think a therapist would have struggled to work with him as well. So.
Yes, entirely possible. Well, so maybe just jumping into the work. So for those who aren't familiar, your reports cover everything from sort of prognostications on sort of the future of mental health. Some of the stuff I enjoy the most, like these deep dives into like, here's a particular company and what's happening with, why are they struggling? Why are they not struggling? Profitability, lack thereof. What does growth look like, et cetera? But then also I think sort of like thought pieces where you do some of your own research, one of which came out very recently that relates to AI, obviously very relevant in a Jiminy Health context where we're thinking a lot about applications of AI and LLMs to improve psychotherapy and the engagement with patients. You found a lot of interesting things in there. You want to maybe summarize for our listeners some of what you found?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I think it's helpful to understand the reason why I did this, and is because I was seeing and hearing a lot of stories that people are now using these conversational AIs for their mental health or for their emotional well-being. Yeah. But, you know, there's not a lot of data. There's actually very little data on like at what rates. And I think some people actually don't believe that they're doing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I'm pretty sure this is happening, but let's go and try and run some research to understand, is this, to what extent, and then try and ask some questions to understand how are they using it? What do they like about it? What don't they like about it? How do they trust it? How do they think about it relative to, you know, more traditional forms of therapy, and try and get answers to those? And so we surveyed 460 people. It's, you know, by no means representative, right? So there's definitely biases within the sample, but I can talk to you about like some of the results. So, and the main one was that we found that 41% of the people who responded had used a conversational AI agent for their mental health. That's a significant.
Now, did that include asking conversational AI what sort of therapy would be most useful for me? Which I feel like is like, that's sort of like the old version of asking Dr. Google for advice, like send me someplace, tell me a thing. Or is that exclusively like, I'm actually sort of conversing with it. I'm having discursive turns in the same way that I might with a therapist. Like, how was your day? I'm struggling and I'm or did it sort of include both?
So it likely includes both, right? So we didn't set, like, I didn't ask questions that would like separate out those use cases and break down that 41%. But from the rest of respondents, there are responses in the survey, you can see that most of the use cases was actually more around like less about signposting towards services,
right?
And much more about actually trying to get direct support with the problems that they were trying to solve. So, you know, when we were kind of asking about like, what do you use it for, right? 63% of the people who had first tried them out of curiosity, but they were really using them because they were like available. And then when we were looking at specific use cases, it was like to talk through problems, to seek advice, you know, even like some levels at lower levels around kind of like seeking companionship and that kind of thing. But it really was actually about trying to solve the problems and whatever emotional or mental problems they were going through.
Yeah. I mean, it's not surprising. We talk about this a lot at Jiminy, and everybody in the field does too. You know, in the United States, which probably has some of the best mental health care in the world, we only have 250,000 therapists for at least 60 million Americans who have been diagnosed with a mental health challenge. And that's the people who've been diagnosed. And of those 250,000, probably half don't actually practice evidence-based medicine. It's a very small group of therapists to take care of an enormous number of people. And in many ways, the standard of care for most people is no care at all, right? That there simply aren't enough therapists. And we can get into, it's interesting because many therapists still have challenges with finding people and there's still matching problems, et cetera. But at the end of the day, there just sort of isn't enough care. And so the access issue is something we think a lot about. And one of the hopes, I suppose, with AI is that it can help solve that problem. But what's happening is people are pushing this even in advance of the technology being ready, it sounds like, because the demand is so intense.
Yep, For sure. And I think that's like one of the biggest messages that like I'm trying to get at, is that in the interim of other solutions, whether we like it or not, people are turning to the solutions that are available to them, right? Like there's a whole bunch of reasons why using ChatGPT for mental health is dangerous. And there's lots of reasons why people shouldn't use it. But like we have to have empathy for the situation.
And I'm sure the people at OpenAI don't actually want you doing that and probably are putting guardrails in place, but it's very difficult if people want it. Yeah.
For sure. And I want us to recognize that this is the reality of what people are doing today, whether we like it or not. And if we start from that understanding, then we can start to, you know, build better solutions, think about regulation, think about how to, you know, get the people who are building these other models to be, you know, be even more thoughtful about what the use cases are for them. But like, we have to recognize that it's happening today. We can't just put our head in the sand and say, oh, people shouldn't use them. They're not designed for it. It's not safe. Yeah, well, they are, right? So, yeah, you know, let's start from there.
Paying attention to latent demand and the way people actually use, you know, it's like build the sidewalks where people actually walk, right? Like pay attention, where's the grass worn down? That's where we should build the sidewalks. I'm struck, 20 years ago, I co-founded a company with Trip Hawkins many years ago. Trip was the founder of Electronic Arts, but before that, he was Steve Jobs' first protege, and he sort of ran marketing at Apple when he was like the first business hired at Apple. And he had this incredible story about how Apple computers kept showing up in businesses. They weren't trying to sell the businesses. They were for home hobbyists. And they would get phone calls from chief information officer saying, we have hundreds of your computers in our office. We want to strike an enterprise deal with you. And he would say, how did those computers even get in your office? And the CIO would literally say things like, I don't have any idea. Like there is no procurement process for somebody to have purchased one of your machines. People just figured out they wanted it so badly. They did it. They figured out how to expense it. They stuck it in a budget that didn't exist. And so let's figure this out. And I think that part of what we're seeing with this demand for people using services that are not really designed for therapy, whether it's, you know, Claude or ChatGPT, or in some ways sort of worse, like something like a Replica, which is designed to be like really engaging, is we need to solve for the core problem, which is that people want this. And that's makes it really important for folks who are in the industry to get the services as good as they can, as fast as they can, and as safe as they can, because it's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
So what else? There were some other things in there that I thought were interesting in regards to trust, which you found.
Yeah. So we found most people actually trust these agents, right?
Yeah.
So 69% of people said that they either completely trust or mostly trust the output of the AI agents when it comes to their mental health purposes, which I think is quite probably surprising and to a lot of people. But then I think, again, when you think about the existing behaviors that we have, you know, with these digital tools, whether it's, you know, with Google or whether it's with an AI agent, like we already give a lot to them, right? We trust them with like directions to where we go. We trust them with restaurant recommendations. We've been trusting them with a lot of our life for like quite a long time. So,
well, probably the first time you used nav software, you were like, this thing's never going to get it right. And then you're like, especially the first time, you know, Waze told you to go some route, they were like, I don't think so. And then you're like, oh, actually that was much better that we avoided all the traffic. You're like, oh, I guess so.
Yeah, exactly. I was driving home from the airport yesterday with my dad, and he's probably a bit lower down on that trust scale. And, you know, we put in Google Maps and it gives us like the estimated time that we're going to arrive home. And he's like, it'll be longer than that. I'm like, I trust Google, actually.
As it turns out, Google knows where every single phone is on the planet and exactly how fast it's moving. They're
pretty good. They're pretty good at this.
Making a good therapy bot that can engage with a human being and teach you the skills of CBT, et cetera, is an even more complex challenge.
It is. And I think that separates, you know, do they trust them versus should they? right? Mm-hmm. And they should, they probably trust them more than they should, actually, especially like the general purpose models that are, you know, not built for this specific use case. But it was interesting as well. We kind of asked about like, okay, well, what influences your trust? And it was really essentially about like how human that they felt the agent was being, right? That kind of emotional sensitivity, that was the biggest driver of trust. They were actually quite interested in like the level of evidence that was behind the tool, and also around kind of the level of respect for like privacy and data, like which was quite important too, which is interesting because one of the main reasons that people are actually choosing to use these tools for mental health is that they actually feel more open,
right,
with disclosing to them. So we asked some questions around comparing them. If they'd worked with a psychotherapist before, you know, how did they compare the service? And a lot of them actually said that they felt that they could be more open with an AI than they could with a therapist, you know. And so then obviously if they're being incredibly open and vulnerable with them, you know, trust around privacy and data becomes very important.
Right. You better not make a mistake. And I think it's incredibly important for all of us who work in the industry that we're even more careful than careful in regards to the PII. And I mean, these are people's most sensitive thoughts and feelings, et cetera.
Exactly.
One of the strengths and weaknesses of humans, I suppose, is that we are so adaptable so quickly. There's a very funny joke. Coming to an airplane, somebody tells them there's Wi-Fi on the airplane. They're like, oh, that's amazing. I had no idea that you could have Wi-Fi on it. This is when Wi-Fi was new on an airplane. You could have Wi-Fi on an airplane. That's fantastic. They get on the plane. The Wi-Fi isn't working for the flight and they're all ticked off, right? And it's perfect, right? Like, I've adapted so quickly that I can be mad about this thing I didn't even know I was going to have until 5 minutes ago. But I think that... for better or for worse, we take on a lot of new technologies that way. And so at first it's, for a second it's scary, then it's kind of amazing and cool, and then it's just like boring and it's the thing that we use to solve our problem. I had somebody describe self-driving cars that way to me recently. I was like, that's exactly right. First you're like, no way. Then you're like, wow, this is amazing. And then you're like, whatever, my Waymo is getting me where I'm going.
Right.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Like the first ride I took in a Waymo, it was like cool. And honestly, within minutes, I was like, huh. And then I just like went back to what I would just have done in a new world. Anyway.
Just a new tool.
It's bizarre.
Yeah. It is. We're like you, working very hard to make sure that the field advances quickly because of all this latent demand, but carefully and safely to make sure that if you're actually taking care of real human beings who are revealing their important secrets or feelings about things that are very important to them. And you're trying to heal people with words, which is a tricky business even for human beings. So maybe switching gears, I was struck. I read one of another report that you'd written that talked a lot about the challenges of getting reimbursed for things, the challenges of mental health, related to the fact that we only reimburse certain things. So within the mental health field, we get reimbursed for therapy, we can get reimbursed for drugs, we can get reimbursed for devices. There's lots of other things that are ultimately sort of good in the long run for your mental health. Good sleep, good nutrition, exercise, mindfulness, all sorts of things for which there is no path to reimbursement, at least not in the US context. And then we have this system where like people are used to healthcare being covered. And if it isn't I have to come out of pocket, it's very challenging. Anyways, I thought this was a really interesting and thoughtful thing because a part of your business is to help companies succeed, right? So like, here's how to think about building your business. So I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that report and some of what you found.
Yeah. I think the title, perhaps the subtitle I had was, the challenge that a lot of the stuff that works, you can't get paid for.
Right.
That's essentially it. This week, I'm actually writing about the impact of social connection on mental health, which, you know, there is a massive evidence base that, you know, if you have poor levels of social connectedness and loneliness in your life, and then you're more likely to suffer from anxiety and depression, and actually a whole bunch of other physical illnesses as well.
The world's greatest longitudinal study, right? That Harvard study. I mean, I think they found, I mean, other than like chronic disease, like the most important things in your life were basically the number of and depth of your social connections.
Yeah.
And I think meaning, having some meaning in your life, right, is reflected in either the work that you did or your spiritual community or something along those lines. And largely all else was noise. I mean, it's a fascinating thing.
It's super fascinating. And it's actually like, it's interesting. So I read those studies and then I've been really trying to implement them into my own life, right? Mm. Because if you want to be an evidence-based and rational person, you say, well, okay, clearly here is like a fantastic study that shows me that what actually matters in my life is some sort of meaning and purpose and basically the friends that I have around me. And then you look at what you're doing in your life, like, okay, that doesn't really match up with that. Why? And it's actually really hard to make that behavior change, even if you're a super rational person and you're aware of it and you have the desire to and everything else. It's the same then in, you know, other determinants of mental health. We know they work. Like all of these things that you mentioned before, right, around like sleep and exercise and like all of these lifestyle interventions. And it's really just like one of the frustrating things about like the system, and it holds us back from being able to implement solutions. But I also understand why, right? It's really difficult to build a reimbursement model that actually pays for this stuff because it's really messy, right? Like it's lifestyle medicine so is like fantastic, but it's super messy. You know, and what are you going to pay? You're going to pay like on a per friend, per new friend basis, or, you know, and then obviously you can pay for like a specific intervention of, okay, I'm going to teach this person how to, you know, build better social connections. Maybe I can charge for a 30-minute education, whatever else. But, you know, then that gets really, really difficult. And
even in a value-based world, which we don't really live in, when you have something that is so confounded, right? Am I happier because I have lots of friends? Do I have lots of friends because I'm happier? Do I, like, what's the study that how big does the study need to be that I would run with a Kaiser or Geisinger to demonstrate that this thing that I had really was ultimately in the medium and long term impacting people's overall health and hence cost to the system would be a very difficult study. It is not like I gave them the drug, we took a picture of the tumor shrank. It's a much more challenging thing.
It's super challenging. And well, I think a couple of things. So one, it's easier or there's more chance of getting paid for it in a value-based care world, right? And the more aggressive a value-based care contract that you can actually enter into, more likely the better reimbursement you can have, because you actually move all the way down to actual outcomes for the population that you're responsible for. And so then you actually do have the freedom to engage in these sort of lifestyle interventions that you know at work. But, you know, what do you do if you can't do that? Because that's not, you know, the reality is for a lot of, especially startups, you can't engage in these VBC contracts.
Right. You have to get through the sort of valley of death in a fee-for-service world, because in order to win a value-based contract, you have to show that it works. You have to build a product that costs a bunch of money. You have to iterate on it, that because you're not going to get it right the first time. And then you have to run a study with the right KOLs and the right institutions who are only going to work with you if you have demonstrated that it largely works in the first. Anyways, it's a multi-year process, and for a startup, it's many millions, if not tens of millions of dollars, kind of to get there.
Yeah, super, super hard. And so I think, you know, the options are to try, and this is hard, but to try and be creative around it. Well, what other models might I be able to implement where, you know, I can at the very least break even for delivering this service, right? And delivering this kind of intervention. So like, I'm actually writing today about, you know, the impact of social connection. And one of the big problems that perhaps we can talk about with some of the mental health businesses, especially in the US, is actually acquiring like patients into their service. And it can be quite expensive, and that puts significant pressure on their unit economics, which is one of the major challenges in the whole industry. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, we have a population that is craving social connection, right? And then we have mental health businesses who will offer therapy or, you know, whatever other intervention they have, but are really struggling for customers. It's like, well, why can't they build some sort of product that provides a solution for the social connection in some element, but really is serving as an on-ramp to their other services? And so you actually put it down as like an acquisition cost, right? Mm-hmm. It goes under your marketing budget. And like we see, like there's, I live in Bondi in Sydney, and every weekend there's an activation from Nike or Lululemon or Hoka or one of these places. He was running a run club and they're doing ice baths afterwards and everyone signs up to it. And it's obviously great marketing for them.
So first of all, you've just confirmed all of my stereotypes about Australia. Like literally, everybody's like, let's go run. And then we're going to jump in the cold water.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. especially in Bondi. But it is true. But I mean, like these companies have kind of tapped into the zeitgeist. Like they understand like the needs that is there from the population that they're trying to serve. And they find creative ways to meet that need. But in a commercially incentivized way, because right. they're obviously building their brand and they're selling right. shoes off the back of this. And I think that's fine. Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I love that. And I think one of the examples you cited in this story was somebody who'd built a sleep app, but instead of talking about like, you know, better sleep is useful for your depression or your anxiety, et cetera. They allowed for like peak performance or something. It was like they structured it in a way that was more appealing from a brand perspective, perhaps to people who were likely to sort of come out of pocket for it until they had enough data to move it into sort of a reimbursed world.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And I think that's kind of, sometimes I have a criticism of parts of the mental health industry that, you know, I think fail to meet people where they are in terms of what they actually want and what they will actually pay for. Mm-hmm. And I think it's okay to meet them there and to get them to pay for something where the secondary benefit is an improvement in their mental health, mm-hmm. right? So not that people are paying for this necessarily, but I think one of the best things, and I think I referenced it in the article, one of the best things that's probably happening for mental health, especially with young people, has been like this rides of run clubs, right? Now, if I went and pitched my friends, it's like, hey guys, we have to go to this run club tomorrow because, you know, the evidence says that it's going to reduce our risk of depression and anxiety, and they're not going to go. Right. But if I go and say, hey guys, when it comes to this run club, there's a load of people that come to it. And actually, there's a load of girls too. And you can meet the girls and the guys, you know, and that's kind of why you're going.
Right. That's the pitch. But ultimately, it's also good for anxiety and depression and loneliness and all the rest
right.
of it.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's, I think we need to understand that. I think it's, you know, people, even in physical health, I think I could be wrong on this, but I think a lot of people want to get into good shape for appearance reasons. They're not necessarily thinking about reducing their risk of cardiovascular disease when they're 65, right? But that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think probably something is similar in mental health, right? If you want to get people to take the actions that reduces their risk, you can't really market to them saying like, hey, this will reduce your risk in, you know, 10 years time. And I think it's okay to, as long as you're kind of ethical about it, it's okay to kind of find ways to pitch that in a way that actually meets them where they are and something that they care about.
Yeah, you sort of structure the choice architecture in a way that like, oh, this is there's an immediate benefit and I see the payoff and the reason I want to do this now. I really personally have tried to structure my own life to your point around exercise. I have two small kids and my career is busy anyway, so I don't have a lot of extra time. So I've tried to structure my exercise time as also social time, right? Because otherwise I'm not going to have any time for friends. And it's, I think it also makes it much more likely that I'm actually going to do the exercise, which I need to do, for all of these reasons.
For sure. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, another common theme, and we've touched on it here a little bit, but I know you spent a lot of time talking about the sort of the impact of poor mental health as a comorbidity with other stuff. I know there was an article that came out recently that you'd cited in regards to like the impact of psychotherapy and antidepressants, for example, on patients with heart disease. I always love to see things like this. It confirms what I believe. We still struggle sometimes with payers. Payers still don't love behavioral health, despite sort of all the positive knock-on effects. I'm curious if this is something that, you know, you plan to go deeper on and have spent much time with.
I want to unpack this more. I think it's hard. Part of me is resistant to, because it's very frustrating, right? And it's very frustrating for founders and people running these businesses, and they come up against, you know, when they've got a great intervention and there are so many benefits, not just for behavioral health outcomes, but for, you know, other and health outcomes, and they just can't get people to pay for it. But yeah, I do want to go deeper into trends within payers.
Yeah,
I don't think that I can, I have anywhere near enough influence to change their minds on these things. But I know there's a lot of very smart and adventurous people who are trying to change their minds. And,
I think it's starting with people understanding what's actually happening. I mean,
right, yeah.
Like nothing disinfects like the light of day and all that. But people, I've met a lot of people with payers. I've never met one who I felt like had poor intentions. Everybody wants.
Oh, sure.
Right. But you have to you have to understand the impact of, first of all, like which therapies do work, because we shouldn't pay for therapies that don't work. Right. And this is actually one of the many challenges in mental and behavioral health too, is that we've had an efficacy challenge. There are things that work. And there are some things that work very well, but historically we've been stuck, for example, with anxiety and depression, we've been stuck at a Cohen's D of 0.35 or something for a very long time. And there was an important revolution that happened sort of with CBT and the other related EBT, DBTs that happened around the same time. There hasn't been an awful lot that has changed in the field since then. Now, we still don't have everybody practicing evidence-based medicine. That's on the therapy side. And then similarly on the therapeutic side, I'm personally cautiously optimistic about what's happening with the advancement of ketamine and MDMA, some of the we talk about them as psychedelics, which is how they are used in a non-medicalized way, but really I think of them as the neuroplastogens, right? That seem to have enormous ability to help people with severe depression, with PTSD, a lot of areas. Anyways, there's a lot of hopeful stuff, but there's also been a lot of challenges historically. And I think that's probably part of why there's been payer pushback. And so if your report can help to elucidate, here are the things that really do work, and here are the trends we're seeing that are really useful, and also here's the stuff that doesn't work, that you shouldn't pay for, et cetera. Anyways, I think that can move the needle. It takes time. Mm.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I completely agree that one of the things that's probably not talked about anywhere near enough is, almost the flat line in the rates of improvement on outcomes for many mental disorders, right? And access, it has been and remains a problem. But if we're just getting people access to treatment that is not improving, that won't get us to where we need to get to. And if I think about, if I'm a payer, right, some of the trends I'm seeing now within payers is they're being pretty tough with their providers in terms of the rates that they're willing to pay. And some of them are negotiating them down, not even up, to stay at pace with inflation. And if I put it into their shoes, I don't know this for certain, I'd be like, hey, I've actually increased my behavioral health costs pretty significantly over the last decade because we had to increase access. And, that was the right thing to do. But you guys aren't giving me any better outcomes.
That's right.
Right. So why should I keep paying you?
I think that's right. And I think it's fair. I think it's incumbent on those of us who are helping to build solutions to demonstrate efficacy. I mean, nobody struggles. Nobody won't pay for amoxicillin, right, for an infection. We know it works, right? The data are incontrovertible, and things get much more complicated. Now, mental behavioral health is always going to be messier because humans are so multifactorial. I think that's right. I think part of what we've heard when we've had conversations with payers, when you talk about specifically, we work in therapy and AI enhanced therapy, is that it's very difficult for payers to understand which therapy is working for whom, right? They end up sort of reimbursing for time. And some therapists are doing a fantastic job. Most therapists perhaps are doing a terrific job practicing evidence-based medicine, and some are not. But very few are actually measuring the outcomes. I mean, I was in therapy for over two decades with many different therapists, and frankly, have never had a PHQ-9 or GAD-7 score recorded. And I think part of what we hope to do with our platform, and I think others who are building digital tools, is, among other things, it's like measure, right? Measure what's happening for the patient throughout their journey. It's incredibly useful for the therapist so that the therapist can modify the treatment path. Oh, this is working or this is not. But it's also useful for the payers. Now I've got copious data that demonstrates not everybody gets better, not everybody gets better at the same pace, et cetera, but that over time, this is generally working. Here's the data to demonstrate that. Now, please cover this, is a much easier conversation to have than like, could trust me on this, right? And yes. I think that's been one of the challenges in the field.
Yes, I completely agree with that.
Terrific. Well, Steve, we could talk all day because like literally for people, again, go to the Hemingway Report. It's terrific. There, like every week there's a new thing. You could read these and we could probably have a 45 minute conversation about each one. But I'm really very happy to have you doing the work that you're doing. I think it's really important for the field. And maybe as just a parting thought, anything that you're reading these days that you think is, doesn't have to be reading, consuming, listening to, like a podcast, a blog, a great book, at the intersection of sort of new technologies, which includes AI, but also other scientific advances and mental and behavioral health. Anything that jumps out at you, or for that matter, it could be a 100-year-old book from Hemingway.
Yeah. Well, actually, somebody I've been reading a lot lately is Alain de Botton. Are you familiar with his?
I am not.
I don't know how you describe. He's a modern day, I guess, philosopher and writer. The book that I'm reading at the minute is called A Therapeutic Journey. Yeah. It's essentially he looks at mental health and well-being. But you know, through the eyes of like a psychologist, but also to the eyes of like a philosopher, and has some really interesting takes on how we should approach it. I found it like really insightful and resonant with me. I was reading it and I was thinking, to come back to your idea around there being kind of therapists who practice like evidence-based medicine and those who don't, right? But even within those who do practice evidence-based medicine, there's a really big distribution in terms of like the quality. And one thing that I've been toying around with lately, I was like, you know, there is like the best therapist somewhere for me, right? Or for a whole category of a population. And how do we get that level of quality to everybody instead of them having to, you know, roll the dice on the distribution curve of effectiveness? And I was reading him and I was like, if I had Alain de Botton as my therapist, like that would be wonderful. Like that's kind of what I wanted, right? I was reading it and I was like, I want to ask him a question now about this chapter, but with the context of my own life. And I think that capability is probably not a million miles away with AI. And I think, so I was thinking about that on the flight.
That's interesting. First of all, it's like all the best books kind of reframe something for you in a way you never sort of thought about it before. And I concur. I think one of the great promises and hopes of AI is that it will allow people to get the best therapy they could for them, right? There's everything from sort of understanding who you are and what you need and what that might mean in terms of the human therapist that you get matched with, but also then the sort of informing the therapeutic process, which will change over time as your own mental state changes over time, which is some combination of understanding the evidence in terms of what humans respond best to, what exercises are working for, you know, is this sort of CBT? Do we need to do cognitive reframing, restructuring? How are we going to do it? Which exercises do you respond to? Which ones do you do not? Do you need sort of a kick in the pants or a pat on the back? I think that is the sort of thing that we can improve algorithmically over time. It is one of the hopes.
And I think maybe this is kind of what I'll leave you with, but when I've written about kind of the adoption of AI in this space, where most technologies like start is by replacing like the human-based version of whatever we've been doing before. But then where they go to next is saying, well, like, oh, well, what new things can we do that humans couldn't even do because we have this new technology? And I think that's going to be very, very interesting in mental health care. Like it came up very recently. The psychologist that I see in Sydney, I was leaving. I was going to be away for a couple of months. She was going on maternity leave. So essentially, we ended the last session. We're like, oh, we're not going to see each other for like a year, even though we've kind of actually just unlocked a couple of things. And so she was like, oh, I can hand you off to my colleague, et cetera, whatever else. But there definitely was some sort of problem that could have been solved there, where, because a lot of it was, much more about discovery and help me to ask questions or whatever else. And I was like, there's definitely a play here where we could develop something new that she could have given to me, prompted, and let me work away on it,
Yeah. Well, I love that insight. I mean, I will say this, we think about this all the time at Jimny. The goal is not just to provide the best CBT you could provide that looks like the CBT that a human therapist could have provided before. I mean, a canonical example is even the best human therapist is typically only available to you 1 hour a week. And there are 167 other hours in the week where you might be having a panic attack, you might be having trouble sleeping, you might be ruminating, also where you should and could be practicing the new skills that you've learned. I'm going to do some cognitive reframing on the black and white thinking that I just did, and I'm going to do an exercise in that in the moment. Your therapist doesn't walk around with you all day long. That's part of why we called it, the company Jiminy. It's like Jiminy Cricket sitting on your shoulder, helping you live your best life. And so for us, for sure, and I think lots of folks in the field now are thinking a lot about, it's not just AI, it's AI plus mobile, which is ubiquitous, right? How can you restructure things that in ways that we hadn't in the past? The same thing is happening on the therapeutic side. I think people are understanding on a deeper level what's happening with your brain as well as your mind. And that is changing the way that we are approaching therapeutics too. So hopefully it's I like to be optimistic about sort of the future of mental health. I think it's a really exciting time.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And I think this is, my macro thesis on this is that, we are still very early in our understanding of the brain and the mind, but we are making rapid progress. And as that scientific progress develops, that will reach the clinic and it will reach real humans. And that's my reason to be hopeful.
Yeah, terrific. Well, I hope you're right. Steve, I really enjoyed the conversation today. Thank you so much for your time and look forward to reading more of the Hemingway Report.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Neural Compass, the Jiminy podcast. If today's conversation sparked something for you, follow us at Instagram, YouTube, or LinkedIn, or explore more at jiminyhealth.com. At Jiminy, we're building the future of mental health care with effective, safe, AI-enabled continuous care. See you next time.